in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, August 19th, 2014. We're joined today by Robert Wenzel. Bob Wenzel is editor and publisher of economicpolicyjournal.com, which, frankly, I visit multiple times a day. No joke. economicpolicyjournal.com. He also publishes the EPJ Daily Alert, which is packed with all kinds of information relevant to what you should be doing with your money. Stay tuned after my conversation with Bob for an announcement or two. Let's bring Bob on the show right now. Bob, welcome to the Tom Woods Show.
Hey, Tom, how are you? Hey, you know, Tom, I got to tell you, there's a lot of weight on your shoulders right now. Now that Peter Schiff is canceling his daily show, you're the only guy out there to speak total truth to the world. This is enormous pressure on you.
It really is. It really is. Well, you're going to help me shoulder some of that today. Well,
okay.
I look at your site, economicpolicyjournal.com, every day, but to say that I look at it every day would be a gross understatement. I look at it repeatedly during the day, and I can't decide if it's hurting or helping my productivity. Like, it hurts it in that the time I spend, but it helps in that you aggregate so much important news with so much great commentary. I guess before I ask you anything of substance, I have to ask, how in the world are you doing this?
Yeah, I tell you, it's a secret trick of mine, Tom, and it's actually, I mean, I'm just very, very focused. I have specific news websites that I go to, and where I know I may not get a libertarian perspective or an Austrian economics perspective, but I know I'll get the facts on something that I think is important, and I can pull it from there and then offer a short commentary, or sometimes, as you know, go into a longer commentary. But I would say overall, there's probably 5 to 10 sites I go to really, really frequently, a few times a day. There's probably another 20 that I'll touch base with during the day. And then if it's a slow day where I can't find any news out there, I can expand it to maybe 50 sites. So it's a very methodical process that I go through in putting things up. And it's really a case, I understand, that if people had free time where they didn't have to work, they could probably go to all 50 of their sites on their own. But obviously, you know, people have lives. So what I try and do is go through all that for them and then just put it in a format where they can get the gist of what's going on. And then because of my libertarian Austrian economics perspective, you know, put a little insight into the stories when necessary, so people understand my thinking from that perspective.
Let's talk about some specifics now. What's going on, in your judgment, in housing? You had a piece not long ago up on the site about owner-equivalent rent and inflation in that. Can you explain that, and what you think that says about the condition of the housing market?
Yeah, I think it's two things going on here. This sort of a price inflation acceleration just in the early stages, I believe, and that's what's going on with the house equivalent rents, because what they really do there is they look at where people are living and who are actually homeowners, and what would happen if they tried to rent that, and so that's where they come up with the equivalent rent data. Now, as far as the housing numbers themselves, I mean, we had a tremendous bear market in real estate, so often you don't really tend to get in the next phase of a Fed manipulated business cycle, it doesn't tend to always continue in with whatever that asset is that was the major boom and bust in the last one, which was the real estate, was the housing market. So the Fed has pumped so much money in since 2008 that you are seeing strength in the housing market, but it's nothing like it was before the financial crisis. So that's going on. But Tom, I think the big story is the developing price inflation. Because what's going on there is you had a tremendous shock to the system when everything sort of collapsed in 2008. People were very fearful. Even people who had their jobs were fearful they might lose their jobs or uncertain about the economy. So what happened is in my thinking, from my perspective, what people did is held on to cash. That's why even though the Fed did pump a lot of money, you didn't really see prices go up as much. It's something that is generally not understood by mainstream economists and even Chicago School economists with their mathematical formula with regard to how inflation happens, because if you increase the money supply, therefore, according to their theory, you're going to get the inflation. Well, you have some inflation, but you don't have dramatic inflation. That's because people were holding on to their cash, just really fearful. And now we're getting out of that, and people are more comfortable spending their money. So therefore, it leads me to believe that we're starting to see the beginning of an acceleration of the price inflation. And I think that's going to be disastrous. I think the Fed is going to be way behind the eight ball. I've got something I put out called the EPJ Daily Alert, which is aimed at people who have investments. So in that, I discuss the different developments in the economy, and my main emphasis now is on this accelerating inflation, or one of my points of emphasis, and the fact that I really think the Fed's real inflation target is more like 3% than the 2% they've stated. So they're not going to become concerned about inflation until it hits 3%. But they're working from a formula that is really just sort of trend following. So they see inflation sort of, moving along close to this 2% supposed target they have. So they're not concerned about that. They don't understand that inflation can really, at some point, accelerate dramatically. So when it hits 3%, which I think would be a trigger point where they may start to do something, I think they're going to be very slow off the bat as far as what they're going to do as far as trying to battle inflation. It's not going to be something like Paul Volcker did in the 1980s when he came in to save the economy after G. William Miller made a mess with it. And what you're going to see, and you've got two inflationists. Janet Yellen is an inflationist. All she ever talks about is inflationary policy. And just yesterday, the vice chairman, Irving Fisher, Stanley Fisher, sorry about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, a guy named Irving Fisher is working there? Okay, all right, go ahead.
But I'll tell you that they were both real. I mean, Irving Fisher messed up the forecast on the 1929 Depression.
Yeah.
He thought the stocks were at a new permanent high. And Stanley Fisher, he's not out of the same camp, but he's making the same kind of mistakes. I mean, he's clearly, in his speech yesterday, there was really no concern about price inflation at this point. And he said in the speech that the Fed needs to be flexible about its target in balancing inflation, because they have to look for concerns they see with regard to financial stability in the economy. So what that tells me is that they're just both really inflationists. If price inflation, the numbers they're watching, which, it's questionable how accurate they are or to the degree they're really getting all the inflation that's out there. But if it's at 2% and that's their supposed target, they're not going to get concerned at 2.3, 2.5. And it's going to be lackadaisical concern at 3%. But it can go from 3%, in my view, so quickly from 3% to 5% that they're going to be so far behind the eight ball. And what's going to happen at that point is they would have to raise interest rates like Paul Volcker did. And we have to remember, short-term rates were hit 17% when Volcker was battling the inflation back then. You may not need short-term rates at at 17% now, you know, who knows where, you know, that would be a market function that could only really tell you that, but it could be 10% or 12%. And we've got this near zero interest rate. The Fed's not gonna raise them quick enough and fast enough, so the inflation could get really, really out of control. It's a very, very dangerous time. And at the same time, while this is going on, my other concern is there's recently been a slowdown in the money supply. Now the Fed has been very, very erratic with regard to the booms and busts, short term bursts with regard to money supply. So you don't know if they're going to turn this around and start printing again, but it could happen. But what's even more remarkable, and then I pointed this out in the alert, is Janet Yellen no longer mentions money supply in her comments, in her speeches, in the Fed minutes, in the Fed's policy statements. There is no discussion. This is absolutely amazing. The one thing the Federal Reserve does control is to a large degree, I mean, there's technicalities where they don't control it completely, but to a large degree, they control the money supply, and it's very, very important, yet they are not talking about the money supply at all. Since Janet Yellen has taken over as chairman of the Federal Reserve, there has been no commentary in any of the Fed minutes or in the monetary policy statements that actually say money supply. They're just not looking at it. They're not focused on it, and so consequently, it could get dramatically out of control before they start looking at it seriously. It's a very, very, very dangerous time, very volatile time, and we're sort of like in the eye of the hurricane right now, and things are a little bit quiet, and people are getting a little confident, but I don't see this lasting.
Bob, of course, the prospect of price inflation is very, a very important issue to focus on, and it can be very damaging. But defenders of the Fed have focused on this obsessively as if rising prices is the only negative outcome of Fed policy, that as long as prices aren't rising, there can't be any negative outcomes of Fed policy. And contrarians like you and me just have it all wrong. Look, they've kept prices relatively low. And if prices are low, there can't possibly be any problems. But there can be problems. Prices stayed low during the 1920s, but there were problems. What do you see going on that the Fed is doing then that even if price inflation doesn't explode in the next year, is still a danger to the economy?
Oh, yeah. That's very, very true, Tom, because what people don't see is when the money supply is increasing, which is really what's causing this any price inflation, or even if it's low price inflation. But if the money supply is increasing, there's no price inflation. That money is flowing somewhere, and what happens is it distorts the capital consumption ratio of the economy the way it would be without those distortions. Murray Rothbard was really great in writing this. As a matter of fact, in his book, America's Great Depression, the first part of that book describes the business cycle from an Austrian school business cycle theory perspective. And I think it's the most important thing where he actually discusses these flows and how it distorts the economy. As a matter of fact, I got permission from the Mises Institute to print that separately, and I've titled it Austrian School Business Cycle Theory, so that way if anybody ever searches out there and is trying to find something on Austrian School Business Cycle Theory, they'll come across Rothbard's explanation of it. But basically what happens when the Fed prints money, it generally tends to go into the capital goods sector. Now, by the capital goods sector, I'm thinking the housing market, the stock market, all the places where you're seeing prices increase now. It's not that there isn't any increases, but it's in the capital goods sector. And as long as that continues, you know, that sort of props up that area. At some point, the Fed generally stops, or any central bank stops their money printing because inflation gets too crazy and they're fearful. And then you have to collapse because you don't have that money flow going into that sector anymore. So it's a distortion from the way the economy would be if there was no Fed money printing, which distorts the economy, and then the central bank always at some point has to stop the money printing, or does stop the money printing for whatever reason, and then that sort of fake structure that was supporting the capital goods sector, the real estate, the stock market crashed. That's what you had in 1929 into the 1930s. And that's what you'll see again at some point. And it quite possibly could be very soon because, again, the money supply has slowed for about the last 3 months or so. And if that continues, I think we'll see another crash. It's, again, the Fed is very erratic. The money supply is very volatile. It jumps around a lot right here. But from what I'm seeing, if this continues, we're in trouble again. Or we'll certainly have some kind of a downturn. But if it could jump up from there if the money supply increases again. But if that flow doesn't continue, then you're going to see the problems in the capital goods sector again, which is the stock market, real estate, all that.
Bob, the acronym BRIC, or the BRICS, is used to refer to Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Now, you don't have to talk about all of them, but do you have a general impression of these places and the health of their economies?
Yeah, there's different things going on with all the economy. I mean, all of them have central bank manipulations, which are distorting the economies. There are differences, though. China is the most interesting. I think there could be a series, perhaps one of the greatest financial crises of all times in China. China is a mixed bag. It came out of communism, so sort of when people were allowed to breathe and have freedom again, there was a lot of creativity and a lot going on that really boosted the Chinese economy very, very strongly. But at the same time, there's still a lot of cronyism in the Chinese economy with the government building all kinds of real estate and property and using central bank, the People's Bank of China money. And it created a great inflation there that was well over 20%. So that scared the People's Bank of China, and so they cut back there. So we're in the early stages of that, where there's a lot of problems in the economy, and every time the central bank pulls back a little bit, they start to develop and show, and then the central bank tries to pump in money, but they know they can't put it too much because the price inflation will go 30%. They're on the verge of almost a hyperinflation and civil unrest. So they're in a very, very delicate period right now where it's very, very dangerous for them. There's something like 60 to 80 million vacant apartments in China. That's an astounding number.
Yeah.
And I really think that a large portion of those are probably uninhabitable. I mean, they were built by crony local government operators, and the local operators were being paid and compensated based on how much they could build versus whether there was demand for it or it made any kind of economic sense at all. So they just put these things up to sort of get notches on their belt and climb in the up in the government structure. So it's an insane situation. There's a lot of creativity going on in certain parts of China. There's pockets of really true free market capitalism going on. In some cases, it's freer than what goes on here in the United States. But at the other hand, there are these this great government overhang that could collapse at any minute. Quickly on Russia. Right now, the stock market's been dropping a lot because of what's going on with the Ukraine crisis. But the Russia is very natural resource oriented economy, and consequently, I think if there's an increase in price inflation somewhere down the road, that will help Russia out to some degree. The central bank is a typical one, but there's an odd thing. Robert Higgs, who's a really solid Austrian school economist, but when there's a new woman that's president of the Russian Central Bank, and she named two people as the economist she follows, and she named Robert Higgs, which was totally surprising. So maybe there's a little hope there that she really understands a little bit and does not print crazy amounts of money in a situation where the government may need it if they have to escalate their war with whatever's going on in Ukraine.
Well, I wonder if Bob Higgs knows about this. That would actually...
Well, you know, I actually emailed him. I when I saw the article, I emailed him. I go, you know, Bob, is this you? I mean, could it be somebody else? And he emailed me back, and he was as surprised as I was, but he doesn't know of any other Robert Higgs that are economists.
Right.
So,
got to be him. That's yeah. That's something else. Now,
right,
look,
right.
Now, before I let you go, I want to ask you the... One other thing that's unrelated to the economy, it might be very, very indirectly related to the economy, but on your site, you blog, I don't know how many times, how many times a day on average would you say that you post a blog post?
You know, I would say there's a minimum of 10, and it may go up to 15 or 20, depending upon what's going on and whatever else I'm working on that day.
Yeah, I mean, that's my view of the world is shaped by what you choose to put on that site. So I get no pressure there. All right. So it's not all just commentary on the economy, though. There is a point of view. You've staked out a point of view, a perspective within the libertarian movement. And it comes through in some of the posts. Now, I don't want to talk about Rand Paul, but I do want to talk about factions, let's say, in the libertarian movement. Now, on the one hand, people say, oh, you shouldn't have infighting, or you shouldn't talk about these faction things. But at the same time, they stay tuned and listen. You know, like they say in theory we shouldn't talk about it, but they're dying to read about it. They want to know about it. What's going on within the libertarian movement that could be of concern that you write about?
Oh, yeah. What's really going on there is there's been this suggestion from some people who call themselves libertarians that in addition to the way I view a libertarian is a person who advocates the non-aggression principle, which really means if people are leaving me alone, respect my freedom, respect my private property, then they're free to do whatever they want. They're free to talk to whoever they want, to think whatever they want, and that's it. There are people that call themselves thick libertarians. I call them libwaps because they're libertarians with appendages who say, no, and a libertarian not only has to be a person that is in favor of the non-aggression principle, but they also have to have a specific view with regard to feminism, with regard to gays. And again, that has nothing to do with libertarian non-aggression principle from my perspective. And
well, I think the point is that they are taking, as you say, what is supposed to be the central idea of libertarianism and saying that it's not really enough for you to have that. Yeah. Strictly speaking, you're a libertarian as long as you believe in the non-aggression principle. But really, if you want to be cool and hip and be at least tolerated by the New York Times, you better make sure and be very loud about the following leftist views that you also hold. I don't see that these are necessary or required. I think in some cases, some of these views might actually be inclined to work against libertarianism over time. And I've even asked somebody on this show, a friend of this show, that if your commitment to egalitarianism doesn't really work out from a libertarian perspective, in other words, let's say we got rid of all the state involvement in the economy and there was still inequality left over, then would you still be a libertarian, or would you say, well, I guess liberty isn't enough, I have to be a socialist? Because that's what happened with John Stuart Mill. Liberty wasn't enough, so he had to move leftward. And the guy said, no, I think I'd probably still be a libertarian. Okay, fair enough, but I'm not confident that they all would, because they've got egalitarianism and all these other views as appendages to liberty, and maybe the appendages outgrow the original body.
Yeah, Tom, I think you're exactly right. It's a very, very slippery slope. And you know, in one post I commented, you know, it's sort of like saying, you know, we should respect a minimum wage or something like that. Not force anybody, not coerce anybody into a minimum wage, but we should advocate a minimum wage. And of course, you know, knowing from an economic perspective, that doesn't work. People get paid what their marginal revenue product is. So you can sort of be a libertarian and be an advocate of minimum wage, but it just doesn't make sense. And the same thing with regard to these people who are having this advocacy for gay rights and feminism and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it gets so close to really getting into an egalitarian perspective. It's very, very dangerous. very dangerous.
Well, and there are people on the so-called libertarian left who, in theory, are for free markets, but you go to their blogs, and they're cheering on strikers, and they're cheering on, of course, not a coercive minimum wage, but they think that that's how the economy works, that wishing makes it so, and they don't want these wages forced upon anybody, but they think wishing makes it so, and this is not, this is a complete diversion from where we ought to be as libertarians. Well, anyway, that's a whole, that's obviously a separate show, right? It was, almost was not fair of me to throw that at you at the very end, but Bob, I want to thank you for your time, of course, and urge people to do as I do, which is to get a lot of your updates on what the Fed is up to and what's going on around the world from economicpolicyjournal.com every single day. Bob, thanks again.
Yeah, Tom, I appreciate it. Thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, everybody, make sure and check out economicpolicyjournal.com. I mentioned an announcement or two. Let's see if I can remember what they are. Yesterday, I hosted the Peter Schiff Show for the last time. The Peter Schiff Show is coming to an end at the end of the month. Peter's going to be doing some podcasting instead. I'll keep you guys up to date on that. But I hosted for the last time, and I said, in honor of hosting for the last time, I am giving this crazy offer for my LibertyClassroom.com site, which a lot of you guys know about, where we've got courses that are taught by me and by people I trust in economics and history in a bunch of different areas, and you can learn in your car, and it's super great. And because it's this special occasion, I was knocking 60% off. How about that? Well, then somebody alerted me later when I went to make the coupon. I instead wrote the amount, the price that I wanted it to be, instead of writing the percent discount. So it ended up being only a 40% discount. So anyway, so I sort of screwed that up. So we're going to keep this going. I was on the math team in high school. I do know how to do math. I just typed in the wrong thing in the wrong cell when making the coupon. So we're keeping that alive for one more day. So go to libertyclassroom.com and use coupon code SHIFF in all caps for that. Of course, make sure you subscribe to this show. We're doing this Monday through Friday at tomwoodsradio.com. You can find subscription links for iTunes and Stitcher at tomwoodsradio.com. And I'd really, really appreciate it if you would subscribe to the show. You get all the episodes sent to you automatically. And tell your friends as well. We're doing this every single day. Some slice of Liberty education is coming to you in a commute-sized package Monday through Friday. So keep on listening. Thanks so much for the support, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.